Good morning. As Barb mentioned, this is kind of the new year, liturgically speaking. And where we end one arc and begin the other. And we always end it in the same way. In a higher church, it would be more, it would be referred to as Christ the King Sunday. And it's a look at the coming, finally, of the kingdom. And all that that entails, and all that that means, and all that that holds for us. So appropriately, we're given the text that is of that time. And this year's text is exactly that text of judgment and of promise in, as we see the coming of the King. And what I'd like to offer you with it, because I know that you know this text. We know it well, and we even see it sometimes on our walls. But I'd like to just remind you of where we have been going thus far in recent, and looking at this ongoing conversation. And so think of the last couple of weeks where Jesus has been proceeding to this place. And this is how it ends. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on the throne in his glory. All nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate one from another, as a shepherd separates sheep from goats. He will put the sheep on his right hand, and the goats on his left. Then the King will say to those at his right hand, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared before you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it when you saw you, when we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it when we saw you sick or in prison and visited you?" And the King will answer them, "Truly I tell you, just as you did it for one of the least of these, who are the members of my family, you did it to me." Then he'll say to those at his left hand, "You who are accursed, depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you gave me clothing. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me." Then they will answer, "Lord, when was it that when we saw you hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not take care of you?" Then he will answer them, "Truly I tell you, just as you did not do it for one of the least of these, you did not do it for me." And these will go away into the eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. I think we all know that there are fundamentally two types of attention in a classroom. One is the general attention of a lecture or a project or a movie or what have you, which is the day-to-day sort of ongoing reality of just being in school. And then there's the other sort of attention. The attention where you finally have it confirmed that, yes, this will be on the test. All of a sudden you hear the rustle of papers and the picking up of pens and the rest as people fully pay attention to make sure that they get what they need to get to achieve the goal. Folks who are in school, am I right? Thought so. In my brief stint as a teacher, I quickly learned to listen for the phrasing and equivocations and the real questions buried underneath the surface when, is this something we need to look at? How should I study this? Of course, always the point was, do I need to say this? And will there be a consequence if I don't? And of course, it's something that we all do. If it's not going to be useful in the time, in the future, we're probably not going to invest a lot of time of it. I can never fully shake the image of my high school math teacher, Mr. Powell, a genial and lovely teacher of the art of calculation. Every time I find myself wanting to do something that I was quite sure wasn't going to be useful in the real world, like calculating the area underneath of a curve, because who could possibly want to do that? Unless, of course, you're going to be papering something that happens to be round. I generally find my way through with a problem less elegantly than I should, but that doesn't stop the echo in my head that says, see, I told you you'd use this. The passage for today is this ultimate test. And we know it is such. It's the capstone teaching moment for Jesus right before we have the passion and the resurrection. You may have heard this text says the parable of the Last Judgment, though it's not a parable in the common sense. You don't have the homespun sort of analogies or winsome characters that we can identify with and cheer for along the way. Instead, you just sort of have this broad, incredible vision that is the Last Judgment. And it is this awesome vision. The Son of God will come in glory and all the angels with him and sit on the throne in glory. All the nations will stand before him and he will separate the sheep from the goats. This is far bigger than any attempt of Hollywood could ever try to be put on. And it's quite the ending, and something that, try though I might, I always find myself wanting to envision such a thing, because I know that I'm probably profoundly missing the idea. I will be surprised when it comes to the end, no matter how fertile our imagination happens to be. But that doesn't mean, so we know the stats and we're familiar with it, and it is awesome. But that doesn't mean that it's a comfortable one all the same. Oftentimes, if you hear this read, you'll hear it conveniently stop at the reward for the righteous and skip the whole thing about departing into the fire prepared for the devil and all his angels. What are we to do with judgment? What are we to do with this separating of ways when honestly it does cause us discomfort? It's awesome, yes. It's hopeful, yes. But it's also a little bit scary. And not the Jesus that we want to hold on to too terribly much. So let's start here. I think we need to say one thing equivocally and clearly, and that is the obvious. At the end of all things, there will be judgment. There will be a reconciliation of all things in the end. Because if there were no judgment, there would be no ultimate sense or hope of justice. The one who puts all things together in the fullness of time will take all things apart not for the sake of wanton destruction or retribution, as we might glean from the popular imagination, but for the sake of establishing the kingdom one promised. And this is an awesome thing. I've actually had occasion to witness times of judgment. And I've attended a number of hearings where the purpose of the hearing was to impose sentence. It's at the end of the trial. All the facts are done. All the arguments have been had. Everything has been laid out. The person has been found guilty. And now it's time to receive the judgment. And I've been there alongside people for whom they're simply there to witness the final chapter, or what they pray to be the final chapter, in their own story of pain and victimization. And I've been there with people for whom they are the ones who, through circumstance and choice, committed crimes and hurt people. And it's always a difficult day, because this is where you hear the stories of, wow, how has this impacted the people who were victims, as well as the expressions of contrition on the part of those who are offenders, offering all that they can give in the name of healing. And at the end of it all, there is the judgment and the pronunciation of sentence, and for some, the commencement of that sentence. When the offender comes, they don't know what's going to happen, so you need to bring a suitcase, because you may well be on your way to prison. And that has a way of focusing the mind. In all the cases that I've sat alongside, I have found these holy days of inflection around which lives will turn from there on, both for the victims and the offenders. And to simply stand in the holy moment and say, Lord, have mercy. And to be accompany those who are going this way and that. For me, this is the image that stuck with me as I've sat with the image of the judge that we are presented here this morning. And perhaps I think this might be part of why this causes us so much discomfort is that it is not really a court scene. We have the division of the sheep and the goats, and the sheep are not asked to present evidence of their good behavior or the goats mitigation of their failings. There is no courtroom drama, there's no arguments, there's no objections, nothing. But there is a judgment simply saying, and this is how it's going to be. When we are at the vision at the end, and have the divine one implementing what is, there really is nothing more to say. The point of inflection has come, and it can be hard to say, well, now what do we do? And where do we go with that? And maybe we need to simply reconcile ourselves with the fact that, yes, that will come. And can we trust the one who is on the throne? But I would also submit that the image of the high judge here is not the only image at work in this accounting. There are more familiar images as well, and comforting ones too. For it is the shepherd who is doing the dividing. In a culture where sheep and goats were herded together with equal care and investment, the shepherd applied to both and are both. Separating the goats from the sheep was a common practice to transition from open grazing to the protection of the barns and the pens. You had to pull the goats out because the goats are the ones that you wanted to put inside. They don't have as much insulation for the cold Palestinian nights. And this was a fairly ordinary thing. The one who is the good shepherd is also the one who is the good judge as well. I think we can trust the level of care and concern that the good shepherd brings even in the final division. And it's the shepherd who does the dividing, and never us. We know that categorizing people into groups is the gateway for a whole multitude of truly dark places. We know that many of the artificial and arbitrary divisions and stratifications of our society have been employed for time out of mind and cause untold marginalization and huge oppression. We have justified war, segregation, dehumanization, and genocide on the back of the divisions of people and the categorizations of peoples and the pseudoscience that we invent to justify it all. Say, these are good people, these are bad people, and you can do what you want to the bad people. But I think, indeed, what I think most significant, but I think what we miss when we engage in that judgment is that it's not our judgment to make, and it's not our vision to have. Because I don't think we are really able to tell one from the next. Indeed, what I think most significant in this whole scene is the commonalities between one and the next, and the differences. Because they really respond the same way. In this vision, both groups called Jesus Lord. as all shall. But neither group is given vision clear enough to discern Jesus among the many who they meet. Both are nothing if not surprised along the way. The whole day seems precisely to be one of shock as both groups try to recollect the moments where they could have seen Jesus before them. Sometimes I'm given to wonder whether the whole point of this vision that Jesus gives us was to level the playing field in the first place and invite us to all serve in the name of Christ, no matter who presents themselves. Because when you serve the great or the small, you are serving Christ. Full stop. No need to read any further. Jesus comes to us and those who we need to serve. And that relieves us from the task of categorizing. That relieves us from needing to do the hard calculation of, well, do they deserve it? Are they qualified? Are they good enough? And of course, I understand, life's a good deal more complicated than that. But it's at least a decent starting point to say, if there is someone in need, you are invited to serve. Because this too is also Christ. As Mother Teresa was often quoted, it is in the poor that we meet Jesus in distressing disguise. What makes the moment of judgment so tough is that there is no way to study for the test. Jesus was often pelted with the question, what must I do in order to be saved? And of course, it's always the human condition. What must we do? We are always looking for the formula for salvation, to get it right, and to do it in the best way possible. Spiritually, we're looking for the right prayer, the proper method, the means of baptism, and the proper doctrinal notions that will sustain life and faith. And we're looking for it in order to assure ourselves that we are fully prepared and got it all right, and we ourselves can be ready to go. But this, too, is also short-sighted. We may come to the family of faith by faith alone, sola fide, as the great reformers would have it. But the message must be this. Grace and faith are great, but they must only be the seeds from which a full life of faith then grows. On that great day of judgment that Jesus lays out for us, it will all come down to words. It is the actions of faith and not the words that matter. There are no catechism questions. No one is asked to recite the creeds, and no one is queried whether they invited Jesus into their hearts or were even baptized. Jesus' judgment here is about what you did and did not do, not what you believed, how you acted, not what you confessed. Of course, this isn't easy. It will always stretch us to consider the judgment in this way, because it always forces us to consider, well, which side might I be on? Where might I end up? And we always have to hold that open because we don't know and we have to leave it to God. The judgment is up to God. Ours is living the life not in the let me know what I must do, because that will be on the final sort of way, but in the way of living that puts the kingdom first in a far more authentic and integrated way than simply doing the work to get the end result. In giving us this vision, Jesus is doing what he's always doing, inviting us to live the kingdom no matter what. And note here that these workings of the kingdom are not all that huge, but they are significant. The blessed are commended for the seemingly mundane, not the massive and overwhelming. Here we are not healing the sick, but we are taking care of them. We are not liberating the prisoners, but we're visiting them. The criterions are not Italian social structures overturned and injustice is put to right, though those, of course, are always part of the kingdom that we lead. But rather, simply the simple things of meeting people and the humanity that we share. Jesus never allows us to take our eyes off of the individual, the needy, and maybe irritating, and possibly the undeserving person who is right in front of us. For it is the individual that allows us to focus and meet the Christ with us. There's an old story that is told of a monk who is fast asleep in the middle of the night and is woken by a knock at the door by a brother monk. And of course, being the one who is charged with that duty and of course being the one who is charged with always welcoming the stranger no matter what, he gets out of his warm bed and shuffles to the door and opens the peephole and was heard to mutter almost underneath his breath, "Christ, is it you again?" We meet Christ all the time. And with the vision of Christ with us, we are invited into service no matter what. Judgment will come as judgment must. And we will be judged not by the level of brownie points that we have accumulated, nor the stars on our crown, but by the degree that grace has found purchase in our lives and is known in our actions. In this we can look to the Lord with confidence, hope, and promise. May God's good gifts of surprise be ours as we meet the Christ all around, now, then, and forevermore. Amen.